Welcome to Ants, Humans, and Stars. I'm Digo, your digital nomad, and one of two proudly gay podcasters. My co-host is here today, Caleb.
An artist with a story to tell.
I assume you're also proud. Who knows?
I don't claim
to know you. No.
We're just strangers.
And, we're going to change the name of the podcast to Perfect Strangers.
Right? We're gay guys of color. So yeah, it'd be completely remade. There's actually like such a 2021 thing to do of like, oh, they were white, so let's just make them people of color and like one has to be gay. Like
somebody has to be gay in that episode. I mean, in that series. Somebody has to be. And they're like,
how do we check our quota?
Today I'm going to cover just in time the Zoot Suit Riots. I didn't know about them until like 2 weeks ago. Heard about that in a podcast. Was like, oh my god, this is important. It's coming up, and I wanted to cover it because I had some questions they didn't cover in that podcast. So yeah, the Zoot Suit Riots of LA, which were the prequel to the LA riots of the 90s. Well, and other riots.
Interesting. Today, I'm going to be talking about the multi-platinum Grammy-winning hip-hop duo that consists of Andre 3000 Benjamin and Antoine Big Boy Patton and their groundbreaking single, Hey Ya.
Hey, yeah.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Yeah. It's iconic.
Definitely iconic. I went through... The Outcast was like... The Outcast. Outcast was... was definitely part of like, you know, university life.
Mm-hmm.
Late university life. I started in 2002 and left 2009.
Okay. Well, hey, it doesn't have to be 4 years. It does not
five,
have to be four.
No,
exactly.
Six. No, seven. My mom's over there be like, is he a graduate?
It's all right.
Have you ever heard of the Zoot Suit Riots yourself?
I have not, so I'm really interested in learning. Literally, the past few episodes, I haven't really known anything about what you've discussed. So I've been learning a lot. So no, I'm interested in learning about this.
And like I said, this was new to me. Like, not even once did I ever hear about this. Like, nothing. Not even, I remember. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the same theme of, we just don't get taught correctly in school
at all.
And if it has to do with minority or oppressed people or black people or anything.
I was going to say, it's like Tulsa and how that Biden is the first president in the history of the United States to address the Tulsa massacre that happened in Oklahoma that killed over 300 people. And it was just like devastating. And I just heard about it several years ago. And that was from my sister. I heard about it for the first time several years ago because my sister in college, she took a minor in African American studies. And so she learned about all this history, and she was coming back like, did you know about him? Do you know about her? Do you know about this event? And so there's just a whole lot that we are not taught.
Bob the drag queen, he was talking about how since he grew up in Atlanta, part of his life, he grew up in Atlanta. They teach Georgia history, Atlanta history, Southern history. Of course, Black history along with that, and it's very important to them. That's part of their curriculum, and that is not the case here in Virginia, and we're just a couple of states up. I don't know any other state. I've never heard of another state. I'm sure there are, but I just haven't heard of another state providing that sort of history for their students. And again, I'm sure there are, but like, that's the thing, like the majority of them, I'm sure, Do not.
But this is stuff that everyone should know, not just
because based on
if you live in the state. Because
it's not their history. It is literally the history of the United States. And we are here today because of what happened in those times. And
these events
today,
and everything.
Mm-hmm. These events will, as with things I've covered before, it's like 1 + 1 = 2. Like, these little things happen.
It explains things for you. You're like, oh, this is okay. So now this is starting to, everything starts to make sense the more you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I'll go first.
Cool.
This has been brought to you by Wikipedia.com, Los Angeles Almanac, History.com, Smithsonian Magazine, PBS.org, Timeline.com, ThoughtCo.com, Britannica.com, and the Library of Congress. Was it necessary to use all these? Not really, but like,
I wanted to cover all your bases.
Exactly. Any one of them told me the story, but like, you know, some focus on different things, and I really wanted to get the bigger picture of the characters included, which is what I was missing in the podcast that I listened to about this. They're like, they covered the riots really well, but then I was like missing information about the people who started it, the Mexicans involved, and so I just wanted more of that info. So, speaking of Mexicans, Jose Diaz, he was born in 1919 to a loving family in the small town of Durango, Mexico. Just 4 years later, the Diaz family fled drought, famine, and the horrors of the Mexican Revolution. They joined millions of refugees who were fleeing northward to seek a better life, as many, many have done since. By 1928, the family has settled just outside the city of Los Angeles. Their new home was relatively isolated from the bustling city. They lived in a bunkhouse, one of many arranged in a cluster set up for ranch hands. The Williams Ranch, where they lived, was like many others, a small but well-connected conservative community where immigrant families settled and built their lives. Given the mobility and labor involved with farm work, most farm workers' children, they didn't finish high school. So Jose Diaz, he finished up the eighth grade, dropped out, and quickly got a job at the Sunny Sally packing plant, where his brother and sister also worked packing vegetables. Socorro and Lino Diaz both described their brother as quiet, reserved, and conservative for his age. As was the custom for their family, Jose obediently gave his earnings from the vegetable packing to his mom to help her support the household. Jose Diaz, however, he joined with the other Mexican Americans in his generation in enjoying jazz. So he was a hard worker, but he loved jazz. His sister Socorro remembered him sporting the white shirt and pegged pants that were part of the controversial zoot suit to attend weekend parties and dances. So, zoot suits. What's a zoot suit?
I know. So I was just thinking, I've heard of zoot suits, and now I'm like, oh, maybe is this okay? So just keep going.
I think you've got an idea. I had an idea once I started reading it. So a zoot suit is a men's suit with a high-waisted, wide-legged, tight-cuffed, pegged trousers and long coats with wide lapels and wide padded shoulders. If you've seen The Mask with Jim Carrey, that yellow suit he's wearing at the Copacabana with Cameron Diaz,
considered a zoot suit.
That's a zoot suit. Gotcha. I mean, way more flashy than they were wearing them in the black and white 1920s. But like, that's like, it's up here, ballooned pants, the tight cuffs at the ankles, those, that kind of shoes, everything, the hat, the brim, everything. That's a zoot suit. And the suits were first associated with African American communities such as Harlem, Chicago, and Detroit in the 1930s. The flowing trousers were tapered at the ankles to prevent jitterbugging couples from getting tripped up while they twirled in the dance halls. Okay. So then there were also, at the same time, there were pachucos. And pachucos were a counterculture that emerged in El Paso, Texas in the late 1930s. The pachucos flourished among Mexican boys and men in their 1940s as a symbol of rebellion, especially in Los Angeles. So it also spread to women, who became known as pachucas, and they were perceived as unruly, irreverently masculine, and completely un-American. Some pachucos adopted strong attitudes of social defiance by smoking weed, dancing, and wearing zoot suits. Tintan was an alter ego of the famous Mexican actor Germán Valdez from the 1940s, and he started to wear zoot suits in his films. And before you knew it, you had young Mexicans and African Americans and any other non-whites rocking the streets in the cool, flashy zoot suit attire. And honestly, like, I'm not about wearing more than a t-shirt and jeans, but like, they look cool to me. I would rock that out if I wanted they look cool.
Yeah, they just do.
I like it.
They don't look bad at all.
Not at all. And they look comfy, by the way. There's like wearing a suit.
Nothing where it's tight.
Like tailored and tight. Mm-hmm. No, that thing was up to the waist here. So your belly is below it, right? So you're good. And then the pants are huge. Everything's flowing. Mm-hmm. It looks comfortable. But Karen.
Okay.
Karen wasn't having it. Mm-mm. Beginning in the early 1930s, approximately 1.8 million Mexican immigrants and native-born Americans of Mexican descent were forced to leave the United States for Mexico during the Mexican repatriation, or let's call it what it was, an ethnic cleansing. It's estimated that 60% of those deported during this time were actually U.S. birthright citizens. That means they were born in the U.S., but they were deported anyway. Yeah. Mainly because whites blamed Mexicans for the Great Depression. Tell me that's not fucked up.
That was the way of the people in charge putting it off on someone else, because actually the reason why there was an influx of Mexicans at the time was because like 20 years earlier, they were coming in to do all this work for cheaper. So, I'm sorry, you're about to talk about all this. Let me stop.
Exactly. But so, okay. So I'm going to talk about the exact timeline. But yeah, you're right. You're right that there was like an influx and out, and it doesn't make sense, but I'm going to iron it out. And it sounds much like what we hear today, doesn't it? Like something's happening unrelated to them,
exactly,
but it's their fault because it's a great scapegoat to use politically, especially. So Great Depression followed by Pearl Harbor, and just a quick refresh on U.S. white history. The attack on Pearl Harbor was a surprise military strike by the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service. They hit the naval base at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu, Hawaii, just before 8 a.m. local time on Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941. By February 1942, so that was 2 months later after that attack, the U.S. government interned Japanese Americans from the West Coast after classifying them as security threats following the United States' entry to World War II. It's totally recognized that racial discrimination on the part of white Californian residents and officials contributed to these injustices. Japanese Americans were placed in concentration camps. California defined anyone with 1/16th or more Japanese lineage as sufficient to be interned. Colonel Carl Benditson, the architect behind the program, went so far as to say that anyone with one drop of Japanese blood qualified. Now, where have we heard that before? Yes, the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians hearings in 1983, 40 years later, it was determined that there had been no just cause for the actions taken against the Japanese Americans and their communities during the World War II. Yet, that same Colonel Carl, was adamantly opposed to calls for reparations to be paid to former camp inmates and their relatives. Typical. So, a recap. The United States and all them white rich people caused the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
All them white rich people caused the Great Depression. Without getting too into it, the stock market crashes, stock markets, white people. Banks being shady, banks, white people. Gold reserves going out of whack, gold, white people. And inept landowners leading to the Dust Bowl, global warming, white people. But who they blame?
Mm-hmm.
The Mexicans.
Exactly.
They're just trying to live. That's a South Park thing.
Okay.
So they deported them all. Japan bombs Hawaii. The U.S. joins World War II. They throw the Japanese into concentration camps. But we need laborers. And I'm not kidding. In 1942, the United States signed the Mexican Farm Labor Agreement with Mexico, also known as the Bracero Program, and bam, all the Mexicans are back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that white people did not like that in the slightest. I mean, they weren't told the truth. They didn't really know what was going on. But still, all they knew was their racism and the fact that there's more Mexicans. And they didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
That was just the truth. So back to Jose. Jose Diaz. He was caught up in the excitement surrounding the United States' entry to World War II. By the summer of 1942, the 22-year-old Jose Diaz was enlisted in the U.S. Army, causing his mom much anxiety. But for him, serving in the Army was a much-anticipated opportunity. More money, honestly. And then also some sort of like, well, you may be Mexican, but you served, so you should get some respect. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not how it happens. That's not how it works.
Yeah, so many black people have that story. Coming mm-hmm. back from war, and you can't even get a job, or you're being hanged in your
just
uniform.
Respect. Just plain old respect. You know, it being hanged in your uniform after you come back from war, that's as pretty much as far from respect as you can possibly get.
Yeah, you're literally killing you after you just put your life on the line to save. Mm-hmm. But that's another story for another day. But I'm done.
We're definitely going to cover that soon. So the weekend before Jose was going to leave, his mom sent him to have his picture taken, the first one he ever had. In the picture, he dressed neatly, hair well combed, looking young and ambitious. That same weekend, he was also to attend a neighbor's birthday party. His murder on the way home from that party at the Williams Ranch on the day before he was reported to the Army makes his first and only picture particularly poignant.
Wow.
On the night of August 1st, 1942, Henry Leavis, also known as Hank by his friends, went out with his neighborhood friends and drove to the Williams Ranch. By day, the young people from the 38th Street neighborhood, where Hank was a part of, used the reservoir near the Williams Ranch as a swimming hole. By night, they used the Sleepy Lagoon, named after a popular song, as Lover's Lane. And P.S., Lover's Lane, bad news.
Yeah.
Yeah, check out episode... fill it in, Digo, here in the future. Right now, fill in what I'm supposed to just record in the future. I don't know what it is, but you know what. Fill this in. Okay.
Episode 15, The Colonial Parkway Murders.
Hank remained in the car with his girlfriend, Dora, while their friends went to the other secluded spots around the lagoon. Before long, a group of boys from a local neighborhood called Downey, also populated with Mexican folk, pulled alongside Hank's car, and a shouting match ensued. The Downey boys, who greatly outnumber Hank and Dora, began beating them. Hank's friends rushed to help, but they could do little, and they were run off by the Downey boys. After the fight, Hank, Dora, and the others went back to the 38th Street for reinforcements. They gathered a large group of friends and returned to the Williams Ranch. But The area was deserted. One of the boys, though, he had heard sounds of a party in the distance, and they drove towards the birthday party at the Delgadillo home, believing they would find the Downey boys there. The boys from Downey, they'd been at the party, but the Delgadillos had ordered them to leave when they became rowdy. So the 38th Street group arrived at the Delgadillos' home at about 1 a.m., ready for a confrontation and a fight. And the fight quickly broke out. The police were called. Several young men and women were seriously injured, including partygoer Jose Diaz. Diaz was pronounced dead early that morning, and the police stepped into action. But not in the way you'd think or that you'd want them to. They took the murder as an opportunity to show their force within the community, as well to target Mexican-American youth, whom they believed to be completely out of control. The following day, the police, they began a dragnet to round up African-American and Mexican-American youth, most of them from East Los Angeles neighborhoods. Hank was one of their prime suspects, and approximately 600 kids were taken into custody on suspicion of involvement with the Sleepy Lagoon murder. And when I say kids, ages 12 to 15. After Hank was arrested, his sister Lupe went to find him. She showed up to the station. She identified herself. The officer in charge said, "Ah, another Leivas." And they locked her in a room with the other girls who had been arrested. One of the investigators threatened to slap her if she did not admit to being at the fight with at the Williams Ranch. A female officer who was also present during the interrogation promised that she would hit Lupe if the male colleague did not. Hank later testified that authorities admitted him into the station under a false name in order to make it difficult for his family and their attorney to find him. They finally found him in the interrogation room, unconscious, slumped over his chair, blood and saliva covering his shirt and mouth. He had been beaten for a confession.
Wow.
Once the trial began, 22 defendants, mostly Mexican and American young men, were put on trial for the murder of Jose Diaz. It was the largest mass trial in California history, and it was biased from the start. Presiding over the court was Judge Charles Frick, who made his disdain for the boys evident. He ruled that the boys had to wear the same clothes they were arrested in, and they could not wash themselves. For all 22 boys, there were only 7 defense lawyers who were not allowed to sit with their clients and could only counsel them during court breaks. Despite the efforts of George Shibley, a talented defense lawyer who was certain of the boys' innocence, both Judge Frick and the prosecution relentlessly labeled the defendants as gang members and singled out Hank as the leader. The trial dragged on from October to January, and the situation worsened. In December, Clem Peoples, chief of the criminal division of the sheriff's office, he published an account of the murder and the following dragnet on Mexican gangs which he conducted. The account appeared in Sensation magazine and featured a large picture of Hank with the words, "Ringleader." And bad press, man. Bad press and racist court proceedings were culprit here, and they continued, and Hank realized that he and others were being made into examples of the city's intolerance for Mexican youth, for any colored youth. And on January 12, 1943, the verdict was read, sentencing 17 of the 22 defendants. The punishment was harsh. The jury found Hank, Jose Ruiz, Bobby Tellez guilty of murder in the first degree and sentenced them to life imprisonment in San Quentin prison. San Quentin is not a good place, although it has a spectacular view. I have driven by San Quentin so many times. It's in Northern California, right outside of San Francisco. It's actually very pretty where it is, but inside is not so pretty, I'm sure. Yeah. P.S. all the boys, they were sent to jails, of course, and then the women that were involved in the scuffle, they were shipped off to reform school for girls. And I'm not even sure they got a trial. I'm not even sure they got anything. I think they were just rounded up and taken.
Wow.
So while Henry and his pals were in jail, the worst violence against Mexican Americans to date occurred on the streets of Los Angeles. Hundreds of servicemen and civilians attacked zoot-suited youth, presumed to be gang members, and juvenile delinquents all over the city in June of 1943. So, before I continue, what just didn't make sense to me, none of this makes sense, but what extra didn't make sense was that this was, as they say, Mexican all Mexican crime. Mexicans battling mm-hmm. Mexicans, Mexicans scuffling with Mexicans. And the police, as per usual, jumped in and they did it completely incorrectly. But I assumed that somewhere in the story it was going to be Mexicans attacked white people, Mexicans attacked some woman. No, they just used any excuse they could find. And it was, you know, this Mexican all Mexican crime that they latched on. And they said, well, if you guys can't behave, we need you out. That seems how it played out, because those riots ensued. And what was the problem here was that there were white sailors from all over the United States ready to go out and fight in World War II against the Nazis and the Japanese that were sailors were in town, and they were getting their fun before they went off to war. So they were in LA getting ready for this big ass fight against these evil people. And at the time, I'm sure they felt very righteous in what they were about to do. But they, when they wanted to have fun, they were forced to have to go through Mexican barrios to get to the nightlife downtown, there and back. So you can see the issue going downtown, having a good night, drinking a lot, walking drunk back home. There'd be scuffles and yeah. On June 3rd, a group of sailors from the Chavez Ravine Armory got into a scuffle with a handful of local pachucos. Word spread quickly through the barracks, and servicemen were soon roaming the streets of downtown Los Angeles, armed with makeshift weapons and targeting anyone with zoot suits. In the days that followed, hundreds of white servicemen, mostly hailing from Middle America and trained in still segregated armed forces, fanned out across the city, wreaking more havoc on similar targets. Taxi drivers even offered free rides to servicemen to rioting areas, and thousands of military personnel and civilians from San Diego and other parts of Southern California converged on Los Angeles to join the mayhem. As one journalist witness to the chaos wrote, "Marching through the streets of downtown Los Angeles, a mob of several thousand soldiers, sailors, and civilians proceeded to beat up every zoot suiter they could find. Pushing their way into motion picture theaters, the mob ordered the management to turn on the house lights and then ran up down the aisles, dragging Mexican out of their seats. Streetcars were halted while Mexicans and Filipinos and Negroes were jerked from their seats, pushed into the streets, and beaten with a sadistic frenzy." Again, this was a quote from a journalist at the time. "This violent response to LA's rapidly diversifying urban population was allowed to continue unchecked for 4 full days. LAPD responded by arresting as many as 500 of the victims, ostensibly for their own protection. The Los Angeles Times heralded the sailors' actions as a great moral lesson for the freak zoot suiters, who, according to Minneapolis Star a week later, were undeniably guilty of a number of killings and rapes. Meanwhile, not a single sailor was detained or arrested. Actually, they were fake arrested, the police would go around the corner and let them go. And this is what we mean by systemic. This is what we mean. It's everywhere. It's in the justice system. It's in the police. It's in the press. It's in how the city is managed. It's how people function. So, leaders of the Mexican-American community implored state and local officials to intervene. The Council for Latin American Youth even sent a telegram to then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt, but their pleas were met with little action. The Navy and Marine Corps Command finally intervened on June 8th to reduce the attacks, confining sailors and Marines to barracks and ordering that Los Angeles be declared off-limits to all military personnel. I did hear on a documentary I watched about this that it wasn't so much that they were worried about them rioting, it's that they were worried that they were going to lose control over their men, like they were just going to not suddenly stop listening to their superiors, mm-hmm. and they were like, oh no, we can't have that happen.
So it wasn't even, yeah, they didn't care about the people and no. who were, yeah, the people being harmed and killed and all that, yeah.
No, I actually heard the multiple superiors were, when it was first starting, they were like, we need to do something about this, and they even egg them on to go do this. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, wait, we're gonna lose control of them. We gotta rein them back in. Military police were dispatched to assist the LAPD in restoring and maintaining order. On June 9th, the Los Angeles City Council enacted emergency resolution to make it illegal to wear zoot suits. But nothing about beating kids.
Exactly. Not at all. Like, how many times have we seen this play out where people are not focused on the issue? Zoot suits are not the problem.
At all. While peace had been mostly restored by June 10th, similarly racially motivated anti-zoot suit violence, whew, that is a sentence, occurred over the next few weeks in other cities, including Chicago, New York, Philadelphia. In response to a formal protest from the Mexican embassy, California governor and future U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren appointed a special committee to determine the cause of the riots. The committee, headed by Los Angeles Bishop Joseph McGuckin, concluded that racism had been the root cause of the violence. Thank God, at least somebody. Along with what the committee said was, quote, an aggravating practice of the press to link the phrase zoot suit with a report of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
However, Los Angeles Mayor Fletcher Bowron, intent on preserving the city's public image, declared that it had been Mexican juvenile delinquents and racist white Southerners who had caused the riots. Racial prejudice, said Mayor Bowron, was not and would not become an issue in Los Angeles.
Crazy.
The week after the riots ended, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt weighed in on the zoot suit riots in her My Day Daily newspaper column. She said, quote, the question goes deeper than just suits. It is a problem with the roots going a long way back, and we do not always face these problems as we should. The next day, the Los Angeles Times fired back in a scathing editorial accusing Mrs. Roosevelt of embracing communist ideology and fanning race discord. Over time, more recent violent uprisings, such as the 1992 LA riots, during which 63 people were killed, have largely removed the zoot suit riots from public memory. While the 1992 riots revealed police brutality and discrimination against the Los Angeles black community, the zoot suit riots illustrate how unrelated social pressures, such as war or a pandemic, can expose and inflame long-suppressed racism into violence, even in a city as racially diverse as Los Angeles. On October 2nd, 1944, The Second District Court of Appeals overturned the Sleepy Lagoon verdicts. And Judge Clement Nye, he dismissed the case, clearing the boys' records. Hank had been, though, by that time, imprisoned for over 2 years. The boys returned to a Los Angeles and a Mexican-American community that had been forever changed. Yet, the boys were eager to return to their old lives. I mean, who wouldn't? Hank quickly started working and even resumed a relationship with his old girlfriend, though he remained bitter. And again, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
And not long after his release, he was imprisoned for selling drugs. It just says selling drugs. I mean, God knows he probably was just selling weed, and he was in prison for 12 years.
But not only that, you have to factor in, drugs aside, what's this, what society and environment was he going back to? He's now a felon. This is the, what, 40s? The late
and 40s? And we're not even talking about his, yeah, 40s. So, we're not even talking about his trauma.
So yeah, again, yeah, not again, but yes, trauma, the environment,
lack of opportunity.
You're a felon, exactly. And so, how much opportunity are you having? And so, it's very easy to fall into the environment of like, oh, selling drugs, because that is the environment that is going to embrace you and say, hey, yeah, come, like, we're not judging you. We'll give you something to do. So. It's not surprising to hear that, because even today we see that a lot of the people who are, you know, selling drugs or on drugs, like you're in that environment, and it is literally a cycle of like, oh, you're in prison. Now you're coming out. We don't want to offer you any opportunities because you have a record. And we live in a society that's like, oh, if you have a record, then you can never do anything. You can't turn your life around. As if to say, yeah, you can't turn your life around. So there's so many factors going into that. I'm just saying that that's not surprising to hear.
Later years, Hank's life did get more stable. He opened a restaurant. It was called Hank's on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles, where many of his family members worked. I tried to find if it was still open, couldn't confirm, but probably not. I think it would be easier to find if it was, or who knows, maybe it changed names. But anyway, while Hank did have girlfriends, he never married. And on July 6, 1971, Hank left a bar in East Los Angeles to call home from a phone booth and tell his family he would be there soon. He went back inside, and not long after, he died of a heart attack. He was 48 years old. And to this day, the Sleepy Lagoon murder, the murder of Jose Diaz, remains officially unsolved.
Wow.
That was my quick recap of the Zoot Suits. The actual riots are very in-depth. I didn't get into the actual physicality of the riots because, again, I wanted to cover Jose Diaz and Hank, and I just wanted to know more about them because that wasn't what was covered as much. And but just to say, one of the most impressive things I remember about the actual riots themselves, well, I mentioned the movie theater. Like, there was a movie theater, and they turned on the lights, and they just dragged the Mexicans out. Mexican-Americans, probably U.S. citizens by that point as well. And most of them were kids there. There was also a famous photo of two kids on the ground surrounded by a mob of white people. And one of the practices was that they would carry these, like, looks like a long ruler, and at the end they would put a razor so that they could cut their suits. So many of these photos of Mexican youth with their Zoot Suits cut, all their pants are cut, because that's what the mob would want to do. And though, there's one little cool thing. I mean, hey, the only reason why the Mexicans were kind of trumped by the mob is because there's just so many of them. There are way more white people, and they were coming from all over America to come and fight for this riot. So, and mm-hmm. they're just outnumbered. But there was this one cool scene where they organized. They sent out like 20 dudes, 20 Mexican Americans dressed mm-hmm. up in their zoot suits to a specific spot in the city. And of course, you know, there come the white people, and there come, you know, there come the sailors, there come all the mob. They were getting blah, 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 blah. But what they didn't know is that there were Mexican zoot suiters waiting for them on the outside. So they came in, a bunch of white people came in to engulf these 20, but then a bunch of Mexican, and they came in, they just beat them, and they threw. It was one victory mm-hmm. and an overall loss of a war to them. But I was just like, hey, that one victory. And I watched this documentary about this, and they actually had some of the people who were actually there on both sides, like the Mexicans who were there, the sailors who were there.
Where did you watch this documentary?
PBS.org. It's
okay.
I saw it on YouTube.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of stories, and so, but suffice to say that they were brutal. They claim that no one died in these riots. I just don't believe that. I just don't.
I was gonna say, when you have the media saying, like, trying to like excuse it and act like it's not that big of a deal, like, you can't really trust.
And what's a no name in perspective of these people at the time, what's a no-name Mexican dying on the street?
I was gonna say that, I was like, again, let's take into context the time. This is the 40s. This is also when black people are just being lynched all across the South, and it's being put, the pictures are being taken, and it's used as a postcard. So I'm more than sure, yeah, that there are people being killed, but the white people in charge don't care. And so if the family, if it hasn't, you know, if the family hasn't figured out that, oh, somebody in my family died, you know, they buried them, blah, 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 and continue to tell that story throughout the years, then yeah, it just gets forgotten. So,
so as I mentioned, which is also ridiculous, like, Mexicans came because they were fleeing a war caused by the Americans to United States, doing, you know, typical immigrant type of labor. They were forced out because of an erroneous tale that they were the cause of a Great Depression. And then they were brought back because why? Because we needed them.
Yeah,
we exactly. needed them.
Exactly.
And then these people just outright ignore that and treat them as, you know, as everything that I described. And it's totally possible that in this this kind of back and forth, I'll send my son back out to the United States, and I just never heard back from him. And who knows what happened, you know? I'm sure that happened. I'm sure people lost track of their family members. Not like a phone line, Facebook, totally disconnected, totally lost, and they probably don't know if they lived or died.
Yeah.
It's possible. So that's why I'm saying, like, there's many articles that were like, oh, you know, no one died. I'm like, I'm not. Somebody
it wasn't
died.
Recorded. Yeah, it wasn't recorded. But again, yeah, like, they didn't care about killing these people. Like, if that's what they wanted to do, that's what they did.
Also, there's lots of stuff. There's so much stuff, but like, the whole reason it's called Los Angeles. It was the full name was Our Lady of the Angels. And of course, the white people thought that was too long, so they just truncated to Los Angeles. I mean, Mexicans and California and Texas and, you know, everything, all those southern states, owe what they are today to black folk coming over 400 years ago, 600 years ago.
Being taken. We ain't rode on boats.
Stolen and brought over. And then later on, other minorities, other ethnicities filling in the gaps of slavery, whether it be China or Japanese or Mexicans, or then later all of Central America into the modern era. Like, immigrants, when they say immigrants have shaped our country, we are built up on the backbone of immigrants. It's not just a saying. It's literally what happened.
Yeah. It's, I mean, even the I'm sorry, finish.
No, that is how we came to be.
Well, not, and it's not only people of color. It's literally the white people that came here were immigrants, because there was whole nations of people here with thriving civilizations. This was not just empty land. Correct. That people were just like, oh, well, nobody's here. Let's pitch a tent.
Correct.
Yeah, the United States is a country built off of immigrants, and that includes the white people, because they were immigrants here.
It basically seems to me that the first white people that were here are the, to them, this is how it seems to their logic, the first white people that were here are the owners, and everyone that came after that, because Irish Americans, they came, they were treated second class citizens, they were treated, you know, this, that, of course, not as extreme as other, but I'm just stating that basically there's this kind of, thing, like, we were here first, and everything after is secondary, even though the natives are like, hello. Yeah. Like, wait, so are we the first? No, not you at all. We, but not you. So none of it makes sense. None of it. You can't say any of it flows logically. And I've said that many, many times. And every time I dive into history, I'm like, yep, there's another example. Here, this. And what I mentioned before as well, that this needs to be taught. It needs to be, you need to know that Mexicans were brought here because we wanted them here.
Yeah.
This whole thing of they came over to take our... They came... They were brought.
Again, it's this othering of people that we see done throughout history. Just as a place to place the blame. So the people who actually are to blame don't have to. Yeah.
That white woman that was raped must have been a Mexican or a black person. I personally haven't reached all the money that I've ever wanted, so it's the fault of the immigrants.
Exactly.
And all you have to say is that either we fucked up, or it's my fault, or we're not where I want because of me, but that is just too hard to swallow for some Karens. What's the, by the way, I couldn't find the consensus of the male Karen.
Oh, yeah. I know. There isn't really one yet. It's just asshole.
There's so many websites that have said, this is the one. And then it's like, no. Yeah, nah, then it's like, I don't really. This is like, Karen is perfect. Yeah, no, I'll just use it as a unisex.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just use a unisex. It sucks, though, because I know some great people personally named Karen.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Exactly. There's a character in my book who I named Karen, and I'm just like, man, I'm probably gonna have to change that.
Is it the villain?
No.
It's like she's the lead hero.
Yeah, she's like one of the, like, yeah, good people. One of, not the main character, but one of those side characters that's influential in all the main characters' lives. Yeah, so that sucks that that's the name. But it's, yeah, but all this stuff is so important. Thank you for educating me, and now I know about that, because I had no clue. I had never heard about that before, and it totally, when you hear these stories, then it really, what it does is the things that are going on today make a whole lot more sense, and it's, you start to connect the dots and see the pattern, and it's like, oh, this is why this is happening, and things start to make sense. Not only do they start to make sense, things start not to make sense. And it's like, okay, well, wait, why are we placing the blame here when, no, the blame is over here. I mean, I learned that firsthand when my senior year. So I went to private school Stego knows, for like up until
heavily
grade,
private.
Yes,
private,
heavily,
private.
Like in the closet, private. And so I had taken, so what public school, the senior history class that public school had, I had taken that in 10th grade already. So I was technically in 12th grade, I was taking a 10th grade history class because I had already taken government. Anyways, the teacher I had, she went through, I remember specifically like World War One and World War Two, and she was breaking things down for us in a way that I had never heard. And she was explaining, you know, this is why this happened, and World War One only happened because of alliances. And then once this country went to war with this country, then this other country was with it. And anyways, it was just breaking down things in a way that I'd never heard. And for the first time, I was like, wow, this is like mind blowing and so interesting. And I just want to sit here all day and tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. Anyways, all that to say that, yeah, there's a whole lot to learn that we don't, that not only is interesting, but it is needed. It is so, so needed.
So you have the X-Men shirt on, and what this is basically telling the X-Men story through the lens of Wolverine over and over and over and over and over and over. And there's no other story.
I gotta clap.
And there's no other story.
Literally, that's exactly how it is. As if there's not 10 other main characters with 10 other completely different viewpoints and storylines. Interesting storylines. Yeah, that's literally, that's American history for you.
That's American history. So, but here at Ants, Humans, and Stars, we're going to give you real history.
We're going to give you the real
tea. I'm going to dive into as much as I can. And I actually even, I got pulled from. I even went in and read articles in Spanish because I was worried, hey, if I'm reading only English articles for this. But even that, I got me thinking, wow, all these textbooks in English.
Yeah.
And I American history. America is made up of all these languages. Can you imagine a wonderful Japanese community and a Japanese text of U.S. history? Mm-hmm. Whew, what's that like? Who knows, you know, from their perspective. So anyways, you gotta be open about, and for kids who are like, but they're forcing me to learn this. Me too, man. I felt the exact same thing. But now you got Google. I didn't have that. Now you can ace your history exam with all that false information to get the grades that you need to freaking function in this society, and then go find out the real tea. And then bring it into school and bring it in, then tell your teacher, this is how it really was, and watch her go crazy. Watch her send you to detention. Tell her, and you go home and you tell your mom, my teacher sent me to detention because I wanted to tell her the real history. And if you have to do that, then you, so be it.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, now fellas.
Yeah.
Yes. What's going on, everybody? We are talking about the one of a kind duo, Andre 3000 and Big Boi, also known as Outkast. So, a little background on them. They formed their group in high school in 1992. They released their debut album. Now, I want to, before I say this, I want to just give an award for best album titles to Outkast, because they have the most inventive, just out there, one of a kind album title. So their first album, their debut album, which came out in 1994, was titled Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music. Music was spelled with a Z, M-U-Z-I-K. And yeah, it's all just one big word. So that just straight out the gate, they were letting you know, like, we are living up to our name. We are not trying to fit into whatever the norm is. So they put out their single from their first album, Players Ball, and that reached number one on the Billboard Hot Rap Tracks chart. And then they followed that up with their album ATLiens in 1996, and then Aquamini in 1998. So they were just on a roll. Then in 2000, they came out with their album Stankonia, which included the single Sorry, Miss Jackson, I Am For Real. Never meant to. Okay, all right. Please don't sue us.
The lawyer was like,
okay. If you finish that line. So that, yeah, that was a huge hit. So in comes the brand new millennium. They are changing things up. And working on different sounds and whatnot. They decided to make a double album. So Big Boi had his album entitled Speaker Box, and Andre 3000 had his album entitled The Love Below. And they literally just mashed that together, and that was their 2003 album. So Hey Ya was a song on Andre's album, and it was first single from that album as a whole, not just his album. Yeah, sorry. So I hope everybody understands and follows. So that was the first single from just both of their joint albums together, but it came from Andre's side, The Love Below. So he wrote the first version of the song in like 2000, and it went through a bunch of different titles. One of them was originally Thank God for Mom and Dad, which that was the line, thank God, Mom and Dad. Okay. When asked about it, he says, quote, the song went through several working titles. That was one of them. That song was actually the oldest one on the album because I had started writing it during the Stankonia tour. So Aaron Mills from the funk band Cameo. Cameo was a band from like the 80s. So I can't remember what their big hit was, but anyways, it was the 80s. Aaron Mills from that group, he was brought in to play bass. And other than him, Andre played all the other instruments. And it's said that the guitar chords that are used were the first ones that he learned. So
Candy?
Kids. Cameo.
Nope.
Candy. Candy's a song. Yeah.
Or Word Up.
I think I know Word Up. Word Up, yeah, is what I'm thinking of.
Okay.
As their big hit. But shout out to Cameo. The band.
The band.
So, yeah, it was said that the guitar chords that he plays were the first ones that he learned. So, you know, anything you want to do, kids, anything you put your mind to, you can do. So he also worked with Pete Novak at the Larrabee Sound Studios in Los Angeles, and they experimented with a bunch of different sound effects, including singing into a vocoder. And that's what like makes your voice sound all
like
weird.
It's like a computerized piano. Kind of.
Yeah,
it's a piano with a mic. Even comes sometimes it can come with just a little mouthpiece for the
it's like a little tube.
But basically, you do stuff with your mouth, with your voice, live, and it's a very DJ. Well, now in the post electronic music phase. Many DJs would have it to just incorporate some sort of vocals over their oomts, 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 oomts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So they did like 30 to 40 takes with each line. Andre's voice is the only one that's actually sung on the album, even though a lot of times it's doubled, so it sounds like there's more. The girl who, when Andre says, hey, ladies, the girl who replies, yeah. That's one girl, and it's just layered. Her voice is layered, so it sounds like a group of ladies instead of just one.
Through my whole life thinking that like Queen was like a whole freaking band, like 50 people. This track, I assume they had like a whole room full of people in the recording studio.
Layering. Give you that choir effect, and it's only two of you. So the song has like a bunch of notable lyrics, like the line "Shake it like a Polaroid picture." When asked about where that line came from, Andre says, "I have no idea." In rap, lyric lyric writing is what comes to mind. That was just the visual I had. And you're apparently not even supposed to do that. Same thing with the line about all the Beyoncés and Lucy Liu's. When I was writing, her video was on. It's great when that happens. You're not thinking. You're just going with it.
So you mean like you're not supposed to, like, yeah, you're not supposed to even shake the Polaroid. Yeah, it's true. You're not even supposed to.
Yeah, I'm going to get into it. When the song came out, so first of all, for the Gen Zers listening, if you don't know, Polaroid pictures are instant photos taken with special cameras that spit out the picture right from the camera after it is snapped. You're not supposed to shake the picture, but most people did anyway because they thought it would help it develop. After the song was released and like became a huge hit, Polaroid actually came out with a statement telling people not to shake the pictures because it can.
Ladies and gentlemen, exactly. You should not shake the freaking Polaroid. Put it in a dark place and just let it do its thing.
Literally. And actually, Polaroid doesn't release like their sales annually, but it's noted that their sales shot up after this song was released and became a huge hit. So, because this is, again, early 2000s, so digital is becoming big. Everybody's having a little digital camera and all that stuff. So the disposable physical is starting to phase out.
Well, that was right at that cusp where Polaroid was better than a camera phone photo. Exactly. Like, right then and that. And then, like, 5 years later, it was like, nah.
Yeah.
Technology.
Because also you had to hold on to that Polaroid. So
it's true.
So the song was released on September 9th, 2003, but it didn't chart until the week ending October 18th, 2003. And it came in at number 57 on the Billboard Hot 100s. And this is 3 weeks after the second single, The Way You Move, from Big Boy's album. I like the way you move. Had debuted. Yeah, and that was at number 25 at the time. So then on December 13th, the song finally reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100, and it stayed there until February 7th, 2004, for an impressive 9-week run. And the digital sales topped the Billboard Hot Digital Tracks for 17 consecutive weeks. And so, again, this is early 2000s, so this is the introduction of Apple and the iPods and LimeWire. And
I was there.
Exactly. This song actually was so popular, it became the most downloaded song on iTunes during that time, when like the service had just started. And it became the first song in history to rack up 1 million downloads, making it the first song to achieve platinum status based off downloads as opposed to physical copies. Of the single being bought. Yeah. So this is, yeah, it's a big deal. The video for it was just as iconic as the song.
That's what I remember the most, obviously. I'm sure,
yeah. Oof. Everybody, even me, when I hear the song, I picture the video and I see Andre 3000 like in the mic singing and dancing. So it was directed
that
by
hair.
Yeah, that hair. So to explain that, the video was directed by Brian Barber. And after listening to the song, he was inspired to create a video around the Beatles' landmark appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show back in February 9th of 1964. Rewind. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back right after these messages. Right,
exactly.
Go to commercial.
All right. Try this again. So the video was directed by Brian Barber, and after listening to the song, he was inspired to create a video around the Beatles' landmark appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964, based on the song's musical structure. So Barber showed Andre 3000 the performance of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show because he had never seen it before, and he came up with the idea of reversing the British invasion by having the American band The Love Below, which is Andre's band in the video, becoming popular on British television programs. So just a little context, if you don't know, in the 60s there was what was called the British invasion. So you had the Beatles, which was the biggest at the time. And there was an influx of a bunch of other British artists and bands that came to America. And if you remember, like two episodes ago, I think, when we talked about Frick, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, that was, again, there was another British invasion in the 80s as well. So that, and that's just what they call it when it comes to music. So yeah, they wanted to flip that on its head and have like, hey, we're gonna have an American invasion in Britain. So the music video was filmed in 2 days in August 2003 on a soundstage at Universal Studios in Los Angeles, California. So yeah, we're just in Los Angeles today. In the video, Andre 3000 plays all eight members of the fictional band The Love Below. He plays keyboardist Benjamin Andre, bassist Possum Aloysius Jenkins.
They gave him names.
Yeah. Vocalist Andre Ice Cold 3000, drummer Dookie Blossom Gaines III, and three backing vocalists known as Love Haters, and guitarist Johnny Vulture. The cast also included over 100 women. If you've seen the video, you know there's like the whole part where you see all the women going crazy and falling out at them performing. Each of Andre 3000's part was shot several times from different angles, and he performed the song 23 times during the course of filming. So yeah, just imagine going and doing karaoke 23 times to the same song and having to be energetic. Like, you gotta keep it up. So because releasing Hey Ya as a single was a last minute decision, Andre didn't have time to choreograph parts, so all the dancing was improvised. Ice Cold 3000 sequence, where the first film, Ice Cold 3000 is him as the main, Andre 3000 is the main singer. And that resulted in the character's energetic performance. And because that was filmed first, so that's why he's like super hyped and dancing all over the place. But then when it came time to Johnny Vulture, who was, let's see, Johnny Vulture was the guitarist, his scenes were shot last, and so by that time Andre was like exhausted, so that's why he's on a stool for that part.
He's like just chilling, sitting there.
Yeah. One of the iconic pieces of the video is his green pants. And when he was asked about it, he said, "I designed those before I had my own label, Benjamin Bixby, using fabric I found in my hometown. I got a seamstress to sew them up for me, and then the year the single came out, I started to see more and more green in people's collections. I don't know if there's such a thing as a royal green, but that's what I like to call it." And, you know, I'd say it's kind of royal green-esque color. So the video debuted on MTV's TRL, which, again, to all you Gen Zers, there was a show on MTV called TRL, and it was a countdown of music videos of all your favorite artists.
And I only found out that meant Total Request Live like a few episodes ago.
Yes. TRL stood for Total Request Live, because you would call in, or I don't know how it happened, you know, towards the end. I'm sure maybe you went online to vote. Yeah, yeah. But you would originally call in and you would vote for what you wanted, what video you wanted to be number one. And so it was a top 10, and that decided whose video landed where. So it, again, it debuted on September 5th, 2013 on TRL at number 10, and it topped the countdown for 19 days. And at the 2004 MTV Video Music Awards, the video won four awards, including Video of the Year, Best Hip Hop Video, Best Special Effects, and Best Art Direction. And just a side note, it was also nominated for Best Direction or Director, I think, but that lost to Jay-Z's 99 Problems.
But yet another example. We need this now. We need to do it. We don't have time for choreo. We don't have time. We just need this done. Oh, wins awards. It was so good.
Because I think I forgot to mention that they were actually going to go with, I can't think of what the song is right now, but they were going to go with another song. And Andre finished Hey Ya just really, not really quick, but he finished it right before they were going to put out the thing, when he was like, "Hey, yeah, wait,
I got this.
Yeah, go with this single first rather than the other one." And so that's what they did. So it all worked out. At the 46th Grammy Awards in 2004, the song won Best Urban Alternative Performance. And it was also nominated for Record of the Year, but it lost to Coldplay's Clocks, which is also, it's a really great song. I can't lie.
It's a song, but...
It's a good song. But don't worry, because the album as a whole by the duo won Album of the Year that year. So they didn't win for Hey Ya, but, you know, the album as a whole still got the big prize. So the classic song saw a resurgence this year when people on social media started breaking things down in meme format. And OutKast officially on their Twitter page, they broke down their song as slightly a bop, but mostly, quote, the saddest song ever written.
No.
And it kind of is. So TikTok user Elizabeth further broke things down by explaining the deeper and somewhat darker meaning of the song. She says, Andre 3000 actually wrote this about modern day relationships, which is true, he did, and how messed up they are. In the beginning of the song, he even references his own relationship, how his baby doesn't want to leave him, how he doesn't really know what the reason is behind it. She continues and says, what he's talking about is in modern day relationships, people stay in them because they just don't want to be alone, not because of their love for the other person. And the lyrics she's referring to are, we get together, oh, we get together, but separate's always better when there's feelings involved. Know what they say, nothing lasts forever. Then what makes love the exception? So why, oh, why, oh, why are we still in denial when we know we're not happy here? But these,
wow, these words are the first time I've heard that just laid out, ironed out. And yeah, those are the words. And I've been hearing those words my whole existence for the last 20 years. And it's like, yeah, that whole time.
Yeah.
It's just like that one sad Christmas song that I keep talking about.
Yeah.
That you're like
Last Christmas.
Last Christmas. And it's so just a sad song. Yeah. And people are dedicating it to people. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay.
If there's one thing that I hope that you all listening get out of this podcast, oh my goodness, I can't speak today. So let's rewind that and do it again. If there's one thing that I hope you guys get out of this podcast, if you've been listening consistently, is that listen to the lyrics, because they might not always mean what you think. It goes all the way back to when we covered The Police with Every Breath You Take. Like, don't play that at your wedding. It is not a sweet, loving song. Listen to the lyrics. So anyways, back to OutKast. Elizabeth goes on to point out that if you just read the lyrics, it actually sounds like a really sad song. Even at the breakdown at the end, he makes a reference to how people are just going to see it as a happy song and not even think about the deeper meaning behind it, nor do they even want to hear about it. And again, the line she's referring is when Andre 3000 sings, y'all don't want to hear me, you just want to dance. So I think the dichotomy between the sad reality of the lyrics and the joyous upbeat of the feel, the joyous upbeat feeling of the song are possibly what makes it so genius. You know, it's like you're dancing and crying at the same time. So that's it. That's the short, concise, little history and insight behind Hey Ya by OutKast, specifically Mr. Andre 3000.
That was so many little things that I never...
Yeah.
And honestly, I saw that music video and I've been meaning to figure out what the hell went on in that music video ever since. I loved it. Mm-hmm. I questioned every, you know, but I just couldn't understand it, and now I get it, and now it's like, and but beyond that, I thought the song was very good, but I didn't think it was deeper than some nice
happy cool song. Yeah.
No,
you've but literally not all all you're thinking is Hey Ya. That's all you're thinking. Uh-huh.
And he seems happy, not, you know. Yeah. It seems like a happy track and everything.
Another thing about the video that I forgot to mention was it's set up so if you watch the video for Hey Ya and then the video for The Way You Move, the other, which is the second single from Big Boy's side of the album, they are meant to seem like they flow, but you can actually watch, like, you can watch The Way You Move first and then Hey Ya, or you can watch Hey Ya first and then The Way You Move, and it's meant to be kind of like they're going into one another. So I don't remember the video for The Way You Move, so I gotta go watch that again. But yeah, there you go. A little Outcast for your out June. Hey!
Happy Pride Month. Happy Pride Month. Happy Juneteenth is coming up. Or is it? Is
it 19th, June 19th. And
yeah,
yep. We celebrating because we weren't liberated on the 4th. So I celebrate Juneteenth.
Yeah, I don't do Memorial Day. I mean, we did a barbecue on Sunday. And
oh, yeah. My cousins did have a whole, you know, little cookout and barbecue and stuff. But
do you get flags out though?
But see, no, Juneteenth is the
I know that, but I'm saying that like Juneteenth is sandwiched between Memorial Day and
and July 4th.
Independence Day, and mm-hmm. like, you know, it has nothing to do with the current. I just always haven't necessarily, mm-hmm. and I guess it's because my family is, you know, Latino, and we're just not
Latino. You know, you said that like a gringo. Mm-hmm. You all say.
Latino, Latinx, and then nowadays, like looking at a flag, we talked about this, like mm-hmm. just and don't write us with all this freaking I'm an American or whatever. But come on, be real. I look at a flag, and I cringe.
I read a great quote. On, I want to say it was Instagram, mm-hmm. and it was something to the effect of patriotism is believing that your country has like done no wrong and is better than all the other ones. Like, that's essentially what patriotism is. And so it's only in America that we force down people's throats this idea of patriotism and being patriotic. And it's just to reinforce this wrong idea that America has done no wrong and that we are in some way superior and above any other country on this mm-hmm. planet, because we have done and committed just as egregious atrocities as any other country has. Our hands are bloodied as well.
And I am comfortable seeing a flag on a flagpole in front of a school. I'm comfortable with seeing a flag on the side of a plane. I'm comfortable with seeing flags wherever they're supposed to be. But draping myself with it, putting a bunch of flags on my front lawn... Well, technically, you're not even supposed to wear the flag.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to even do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's written somewhere in some crazy white person law. but definitely, if I'm going to have any semblance of pride for this country, it's not going to start with that flag. That flag means so much bitterness to me.
Well, it's just, I mean, for me, it's also, I look at it as none of this stuff was meant to represent me as a black person. This was, I was excluded. This was not for me. So to now try and tell me that I need to love it and I need to, also, everything to me just goes back to, and I'll just end it here. Everything that I have as a black person, I got because, thankfully, because of the black people who came before me and fought and demanded it. America itself has never given me anything. Not once has America said, you know what? We've been really crappy to y'all. Let's fix this. Let's give you everything that I have. All the freedoms that I have as a black American, I have because of my ancestors and the black people before me fought for it and demanded it. That is the only reason that I have the freedoms that I have today. So this idea that I'm supposed to thank America, like, no, America has done nothing for me. The black Americans have done everything.
Does that, and does that mean that you're a bad person?
No.
Does that mean that you don't pay your taxes?
No.
Does that mean that you don't love your family and your friends and your neighbors?
No. And it doesn't mean that
I'm an outstanding citizen who recognizes the truth of the past.
Exactly.
Just because we bring truth doesn't mean that we're terrible people. If anything, I don't know, I'd say great people. But to recognize truth doesn't equal me being whatever you think.
Un-American or unpatriotic.
And then therefore I am nothing but evil.
Yeah, no, that's just ridiculous. Acknowledging. And yeah, nobody's saying like, oh, we hate this country or it's the worst country or something. Like, no, it's just like, hey, let's acknowledge. In the same way that we acknowledge in ourselves that, hey, I do wrong, I mess up, I hurt people sometimes, even it might be unintentionally. In the same way that we do that as humans and individuals, it's okay to do that for your country. And say, no, this place is a mess. It's screwed up. It has some really great things, but it has some extremely terrible things as well. And the reason why it's like that is because the country is made up of humans. And so we as humans are flawed and we are not perfect. So a country made up and run and created by humans is also going to be extremely flawed and not perfect.
So, Christ, why do I always forget the sign off?
Fight for what you love. I was waiting. I was like, I didn't want to say it because I was like, maybe he wanted to say something else. But yes, fight for what you love. More importantly, fight for what's right.
Fight for what's right.
Mm-hmm. And know your history. So,
I realized a long time ago that if I was going to do anything live, I'm going to be one of those people, live comedians with a freaking towel who's like got it on the side, and I'm just like, anyways, as I was saying, as you try to ignore that, it's covered in sweat.
I was just trying to give you your moment. I was like, he's having a moment over there with his towel, I'm gonna just let them get it on. He's patting himself down like a preacher that's been he's been preaching for the last 45 minutes. It's a Sunday morning. It's hot in July. And he got to pat himself down. Can somebody get the pastor some water? Get the pastor a couple, and make sure there's plenty of ice in it too.